Well, good afternoon, everyone. And I want to say hello to those who are on the webcast as well. Hope you're doing as good as you possibly can. It's always a pleasure to be here, and I want to thank Mr. Kevin Call for his opportunity to be with you again. I was just here 2 weeks ago, so I hope you don't get sick of me. But that was wonderful music. That was so great, Laura. Your beautiful voice and very meaningful. I think it touches all of us because of the things that we go through. And we certainly can appreciate that, you know, considering what Mr. Call was talking about with all the people that have passed away and gone on. And, you know, it's hard to think about all those people. I knew a lot of people down in Tennessee and Kentucky, where we used to be, and I always hate going to funerals, you know. I mean, we need to do that, but it's just sometimes that sad thing is left behind, you know. So anyway, you know, we all have other things that we're dealing with, too. The sermon will touch on a lot of that today, and hopefully it'll be very helpful. Getting some help today, I have a PowerPoint, and Maya's going to be helping me with that. So you have a handout there which has all the scriptures. If you didn't get a copy, then you can pick one up after services today. It's got all the scriptures on it, but all the scriptures will be up on the screen, as well as other images. So just relax, sit back and absorb. You don't have to turn to the Bible. You can just concentrate on the message. I know it's hard to do that. As I get older, you know, I'm like, how do I get to that page? You know, it's harder to turn things. And I appreciate what Mr. Call's message, you know, about aging. I'll be 75 this month, and you know, I notice it's not easy as it used to be. My dad was, when he was my age, I'd go and visit him and help him with things around the house and the yard, and I'd pick up something, and I'd had to pick it up, and he'd say, "John, that's too heavy for you. You can't," you know, I was like 40 years old or 50 or whatever. I pick it up, no problem. He could hardly lift it, you know, because of his age. He was about my age. And I'm feeling the same thing now. I can't lift up things. Linda says, "Can you haul this out of here?" Well, if you take half of it out, you know, I'll be able to maybe lift it. So I really appreciate that, and I'm sure you all understand that system, you know. But the title of the sermon today is How You Can Be of Good Cheer. Now, when we come here, you guys are the most cheerful congregation we've ever visited, you know. But we can all appreciate how we can do that even better. So, you know, in John 16, verse 33, you don't need to turn there. We'll see that on the handout a little later. But Jesus Christ encouraged his disciples to be of good cheer. And that's the title of the sermon. So let's learn how we can better follow his advice, how it can benefit us significantly as we live our Christian lives. But first, before covering that topic, let's consider an event that occurred during World War II. You're going to get a little history lesson here. I like to do that from time to time. That can illustrate this point of being cheerful, which involves, of course, optimism and confidence and courage in the face of real difficult trials many times. On D-Day, June 6, 1944, what was also called Operation Overlord, which was an Allied military force of 150,000 soldiers, 7,000 ships, and 11,000 aircraft assaulted the 50 miles of France's Normandy coastline. In doing so, they began the long-awaited and much-anticipated campaign to defeat Nazi Germany and to free the oppressed people of Europe from that basic slavery that they were under with the Nazis. Fighting was fierce during the beach landings, and although the process inland against powerful German resistance was initially slow. It took some time to get through the hedgerows and all that in that area. But by mid-August, the Allies were able to break out of Normandy. And after the liberation of Paris in late August, the Allies advanced more rapidly against the German armed forces, which is called the Wehrmacht in German. However, in doing so, the Allies began overrunning their supply lines. They were moving so fast, they were moving faster than they could supply their troops. And they were forced to decelerate their drive eastward toward Germany. Well, this temporary lessening of the Allied offensive maneuvers permitted the Wehrmacht to regroup, and it gave German Chancellor or Führer Adolf Hitler and his generals a chance to execute a countermove against the Allies. So at 5:30 a.m. on December 16th, under the cover of dense fog, which prevented Allied aircraft attacks against the Wehrmacht, the Germans launched the operation, what they call Autumn Mist, which was the strongest and most desperate offensive of the Allied invasion period. Described by the Allies as the Ardennes Offensive and dubbed by the media as the Battle of the Bulge, 18 German infantry divisions, which included a quarter million troops, advanced through an 80-mile stretch of the dense, hilly Ardennes Forest in eastern Belgium. The German Blitzkrieg battle plan included the use of 1,000 tanks and self-propelled guns, 1,900 artillery pieces, and 2,000 fixed-wing and jet aircraft. Hitler's objectives in this attack included not only splitting apart the powerful 1st and 3rd Allied armies, but capturing the vital port of Antwerp in Belgium, which the Allies were using as their only forward supply harbor. So a lot of munitions and trucks and tanks were coming in there. So the Germans wanted to stop that. They wanted to attack that and keep it from happening. So they wanted to overrun that area. Well, since the Allies were unable to support their ground troops by air and strafing missions and bombing because of the fog, the dense fog, the Wehrmacht was able to create a 60-mile westward bulge in the American lines and push 80,000 lightly defended soldiers into full retreat, American soldiers. And facing these startling conditions, part of that included the 8,000-man 101st Infantry Division, which was encircled and forced to surrender. So you had 8,000 men that were captured by the Germans, and they were disarmed, of course. So in facing these terrible conditions, the Supreme Allied Commander Dwight Eisenhower called a meeting of his commanders and staff on December 19th at his headquarters in Verdun, France, located about 250 miles east of Paris. Including in this conference were Generals Omar Bradley, Jacob Devers, George Patton Jr., probably remember that name from the movie especially, and Air Chief Marshal Arthur Tedder, he was British, and all their staff officers were there. He called this conference. General Eisenhower began the conference with these significant words, and I quote, "The present situation is to be regarded as an opportunity for us and not a disaster. There will only be cheerful faces at this conference table." But why was General Eisenhower so optimistic? Why did he expect his commanders and staff to be as well? Also, why did he view the situation as an opportunity, when at first glance it appeared to be devastating? Eisenhower was confident because he realized something important, that the Wehrmacht had actually moved itself into a trap which the Allies could powerfully attack on its flanks. The generals and their staff promptly set in motion a strategy to confront and halt the German assault. Included in this plan was to have General Patton disengage 6 armored divisions of his 3rd Army immediately from their frontline combat down in the south of France near the Lorraine region. So Patton's tanks and troops moved swiftly north from there. And if you remember, if you saw the Patton movie, I mean, he just stopped everything and sent those guys up there. They were already engaged in combat, and they had to withdraw from that and move a long way north. So these are all American troops under his command there. But anyway, they moved north to relieve the U.S. 101st Airborne Division at Bastogne. That's a small Belgian town near the vital road junction that was the pathway to further German expansion. So they knew they needed to get on that right away. In addition, a joint force of British and American troops led by British Field Marshal Bernard Montgomery, who were operating north of the German incursion, they moved south. So you had Patton moving north from where he was and Montgomery's forces moving south. This untenable situation for the Wehrmacht, what happened here is the combination of Patton's and Montgomery's forces caused the enemy to be placed in a giant, what they call a pincer movement, between so that they would squeeze these troops and attack them on both sides. And that's untenable for an army to be attacked from both sides. So anyway, that's what the Americans understood, and the British, of course. So when they did this, the Allies captured thousands of German troops right east of Bastogne as they were attempting to head toward the coast. And by January 28th, just 6 weeks after the Wehrmacht's initial assault, the Allies had driven them back to their original positions. These are the remaining troops that they hadn't killed or captured. The Allies' success in the Battle of the Bulge resulted from critical strategic and tactical decisions and actions that were taken to slow and finally stop the German advance. But intrinsic to their success was General Eisenhower's optimism when he and his generals were faced with serious adversity. Remember that, because we'll be talking about that, about this basic idea. But again, what does this have to do with us? What does it have to do with us as brethren of God's church today? What can we learn from Eisenhower's confident approach that can aid us in growing and developing spiritual maturity? Well, just as he expected his military team to deal with the enemy threat in a very resolute manner, so does God expect us to bear up under great stress, to stand firm in the faith while courageously facing trials and assaults and sufferings. And some of these last a long time. And I'm sure some of those who are listening today on the webcast understand that, you know, because especially, you know, as you heard from in the sermonette, you get older and things just don't work very well and it's hard to recover. And so we have a lot of people right here who are probably dealing with things like that right now. Here's what the Apostle Paul wrote to us. In 2 Timothy 2, verse 3, he said, who's he talking to? He's talking to the brethren then and also to us today. You, therefore, endure hardship as what? A good soldier of Jesus Christ. You see the comparison there with what happened during the Battle of the Bulge? They had good soldiers that were fighting and were under command of generals that were positive and upbeat and confident. And they moved in that same direction. They overcame the enemy. So how can we accomplish this? Paul gives us the answer. He says in Ephesians 6, verse 13, this is from the New Living Translation, it says, "Therefore put on every piece of God's armor, so you will be able to resist the enemy in the time of evil. Then after the battle, you will still be standing firm." The battle. You know, you and I are in a battle today in different ways. Everyone is different, and we have to stand firm. We have to stand fast. This requires, as Paul said in Philippians 1, verse 6, not on your handout, it'll be there later, but he said, "Being confident of this very thing, being confident of this thing, that he who began a good work in you will complete it until the day of Jesus Christ." God is going to complete that. He wants us to believe that and to live that way, that Christ is going to help us through these battles, no matter how difficult they are. That passage alone leaves us with no doubt that if we faithfully follow Christ, we can accomplish this. There's no doubt. So when General Eisenhower said, "There will only be cheerful faces at this conference table," he was in some measure echoing similar words of Jesus Christ, who addressed his disciples by saying, here's John 6:33, "These things I have spoken to you, that in me, through him, through Jesus Christ and what he did for us, you may have peace." Peace in the midst of the storms that we face. In the world, you will have tribulation. Right? We have it, plenty of it. "But be of good cheer. I have overcome the world." He's done it. He's gone before us. He's shown us the pathway. So there's no reason why we can't make it. So when we deal with difficult trials and troubles, because we can look at what Jesus Christ did for us by triumphing over sin and even death. So through his resurrection and ascension to heaven, he is our advocate with the Father. He's right there on the throne with his Father right now, hearing and understanding our prayers to him. He's there guiding us. He is the author of eternal salvation to all who obey him. Yeah, obey. That's a tough thing for this world, isn't it, today? Indeed, as we read in Hebrews 8, verse 1, it says, "We have such a high priest who is seated at the right hand of the throne of the majesty in the heavens." Imagine that. See him on the throne there, and he understands and knows what we're going through. Every one of us totally understands it. So Christ knew perfectly well that we, as his faithful, obedient disciples, would obtain spiritual victory if we remained devoted to him and continued following his way of life, the way of life that Jesus taught. Since we can always count on him to guide and strengthen and help us, we can be optimistic. We can be confident. We can be courageous, just as Eisenhower was, and yet even more so, right? The good cheer Jesus Christ desires us to have is certainly not a momentary respite from trouble, which is the so-called peace that human society gives us. You know, we're looking at what's happening in our country today, and we have a new president, and it's like everything is nice and great. It's going to be that way. Forget it. It's, to me, it's like, you know, the sky's opened up. You know, maybe we got a little bit of sunshine, but those clouds are going to close in again because you have enemies, and Satan the devil doesn't like success in the world. But it's a temporary thing that happens. That's a so-called peace that human society gives you. Rather, what we want is a durable, divine peace and comfort in our hearts and minds, even when we face these inevitable difficulties and dilemmas in life. Jesus expressed it this way. He said in John 14, verse 27, "Peace I give to you, peace I leave with you. My peace I give to you, not as the world gives, do I give it to you." And then he says, "Let not your heart be troubled." That's easy to say, hard to do, as we all know. Been there, done that. "Let not your heart be troubled, though, neither let it be afraid." So this joyful optimism is possible because we know that God not only protects and guides us through our physical lives, but gives us the guarantee of a magnificent future as divine spirit beings in God's coming kingdom and family. And that seems so far away sometimes, doesn't it, when we're in the midst of a painful night and we can't sleep and whatever else is going on. Are we dealing with someone who just passed away, died, and the pain is there? But knowing what God has given us can help us have the serenity that we need when we face adversity, when we face suffering. King David of ancient Israel wrote this in Psalm 116, verse 7 and 8. This is from the New Century Version. He said, "I said to myself," I like this, just the way it's when it's transcribed here. "I said to myself, relax, because the Lord takes care of you. Lord, you saved me from death. You stopped my eyes from crying. You kept me from being defeated." So he went through all of that emotion, and yet he came out the other side undefeated. Why? Because he put his trust in God. That's what David did. No wonder he was a man after God's own heart, right? So just as David trusted God implicitly when he endured hard times, we can rely on our all-powerful Creator to help us contend with life's so many challenges. You know, again, the Bible is filled with numerous examples and statements showing that God is always ready, willing, and able to comfort and encourage humble, repentant people who are striving to obey Him. For example, we read in Isaiah 40, 1 verse 10, he says, "Fear not, for I am with you. Do not be dismayed, for I am your God. I will strengthen you. Yes, I will help you." These are promises he's telling us here. "I will uphold you with my righteous right hand." God's strength and scriptural assurances like these help chase away our natural human fears. And we all have them, right? And yet, here we have the power of God's Spirit working within us. So that can help us leave worrying and fretting behind. Again, easy to say, right? Not easy to do. But those are the words from God right there. I'd like to illustrate this with this point with a really remarkable biblical story involving the prophet Elisha and his young servant. Now, this is nothing new to most of us, but let's review it anyway. In Elisha's time, the kingdom of Syria launched military assaults repeatedly against the nation of Israel. And each time, in advance, God informed his prophet Elisha about Syria's attack plans. Then Elisha, what he did is he immediately told Jehoram, the king of Israel, about those so that he could prepare to counter the enemy's forces and defeat them in every battle. Of course, the king of Assyria didn't know any of this, and thinking that perhaps he had a traitor or a spy in his own inner circle, the Syrian king, he called his advisors in, and he demanded to know who this person could possibly be. 2 Kings 6, verse 12 says this, And one of his servants said, "None, my lord, O king, but Elisha, the prophet who is in Israel, tells the king of Israel the words that you speak in your own bedroom." In other words, anything you say, Elisha's going to find out. Even in your own bedroom. While the Syrian king learned that it was, when he found out that it was Elisha who was informing Israel's king of the attack plans, he commanded his military leaders to go capture Elisha at his hometown in Dothan in northern Israel. Therefore he, here in verse 14, it says, "Therefore he sent horses and chariots and a great army there. And they came by night and surrounded the city." Imagine the shock and the surprise of Elisha's young servant who experienced what he experienced when he woke up that next morning to see the small town of Dothan surrounded completely by enemy troops. Verse 15, "And when the servant of the man of God, Elisha, arose early, went out, and there was an army surrounding the city with horses and chariots. And his servant said to him, to Elisha, 'Alas, my master, what shall we do?'" So he's all freaking out. He's just like, "What in the world? What are we going to do?" So while the sight of this large army terrified this young servant, what was Elisha's reaction? What did he tell his panicked servant? Verse 16, "So he answered, 'Do not fear, for those who are with us are more than those who are with them.'" I'm sure the servant like, "What is going on with my master?" It must have mystified this young man. What is he talking about? Well, Elisha then quickly asked God in prayer to make it possible for her servant to grasp the situation's true spiritual reality. Verse 17, "And Elisha prayed and said, 'Lord, I pray, open his eyes that he may say, open my servant's eyes.' Then the Lord opened the eyes of the young man, and he saw, and behold, the mountain was full of horses and chariots of fire all around Elisha." All around the city. The servant saw that the entire city was surrounded by horses and fiery chariots, a huge army of angels primed to protect Elisha and himself from these Syrian forces. We learn what happens next after Elisha prayed a prayer to God that took merely 2 seconds. Verse 18, "So when the Syrians came down to him," you know, he's ready to attack, they are, "Elisha prayed to the Lord and said, 'Strike this people, I pray, with blindness.'" 2 second prayer, right? "And he struck them with blindness according to the word of Elisha." How fast can God answer your prayers? How can he? May not do it that quick, but how fast can he do it? There's an example right there. God acted instantaneously in response to Elisha's request. Verses 19 and 20 go on to describe how the temporarily blinded men were led away by Elisha to a city about 10 miles away. Once inside the city, God restored the soldiers' eyesight, and then they discovered they were captives of Jehoram, the king of Israel. As verses 21 to 23 further explain, by Elisha's instructions, the captives were not mistreated. They were given a good meal, were provided supplies for their journey back to Syria, and they were sent on their way home. This merciful act proved to be a remedy for one of Israel's problems. after that. Feed those who are hungry, be good to your enemies. Kind of right there, right? And these soldiers reported Israel's kindness. And after that, all further attacks from the Syrians stopped. What, therefore, is the important biblical lesson that we can learn from this example of this, of God's power, his help to Elisha and his servant? Well, just like Elisha's servant, we may sometimes feel that we are under assault by terrible trials and problems and are tempted to panic. You ever feel that way? Something comes out of nowhere and all of a sudden you're like, oh, what am I going to do? But the truth is, the spiritual truth, the powerful spiritual truth is that we have incredibly more going for us than we have going against us. Just like Elisha's words. You and I have that same, in that same situation. We have that relationship with God. Now, often when we've been in the church a long time, God is going to test our faith. He's going to put us through our paces to see if we're going to trust him. And some of these battles last a long time. Some of these trials last a long time. So we have to remember that. We can't be impatient. We have to be long-suffering. You know the old word, long-suffering? I don't like that word, but it is what it is. It's patience. So sometimes in these trials, in the midst of a difficult time, we just don't see God's chariots of fire, right? Just like Elisha's servant didn't see them. When that occurs, we need to ask God to open our spiritual eyes, you might say, so we can recognize the divine forces that God has arrayed on our side. We need to prayerfully seek his help in order to put our full trust in him. And that's, see, maybe that's a thing. We need to, when we go through this, God's testing us. I want to know how deep my brethren's faith is now. So he's putting us through our paces. But there are many ways that God can deal with these situations for us. You know, as a result of Christ's divine command, let not your heart be troubled, we can have true confidence, godly confidence, so as to resist negative thoughts and these impulses that come in our mind and heart, even when we're confronting significant opposition or unfair treatment. Somebody's in your face yelling at you. It's easy to panic. That's the time to ask God, Father, I need your help here. And therefore, we ought to be, Paul said, pray without ceasing. We have to have that kind of relationship with Jesus Christ and the Father at all times. Plus, even by doing this, we can actually appreciate what may appear to be setbacks are actually opportunities for our spiritual growth. So we want to grow and mature spiritually. And none of us are too old to have to be able to do that. Apostle Paul expressed it this way when he wrote in 2 Corinthians 2, verse 10, for the sake of Christ, then, I am content. Look at this. I am content with weaknesses, insults, hardships, persecutions, and calamities. For when I am weak, then I am strong. Why is he strong? Because he's relying on his Father in heaven. That's why he's strong. And he's giving him that support and strength. You know, we can have the same optimistic approach. We can eliminate wasteful mental and emotional energy on needless worry. Really. Again, I know it's hard to do. None of us can do it very easily. But that's what we need to do. Furthermore, we can deal with these situations that we find ourselves in by means of wisdom and faith. And see, those are qualities we should be praying asking God to build up within us every day. Because you never know when you're going to hit one of these brick walls. So you can't be building it up after you hit the brick wall. Now's the time to do it beforehand. So we can have that wisdom, that faith. And again, that comes through a sincere prayer to God. This can apply in every situation, whether we're enduring a difficult time at school. We have young people here. You get some situations, what am I going to do? What am I going to do? Well, first of all, do your homework the night before, then you'll be okay. That's a good thing to do. But it can happen anytime, at work, at home, whatever, these situations we face. Or perhaps, for example, being stuck in a traffic jam. That's one thing I don't like at all. I know, I just like getting in a traffic jam. We were on our way to Tennessee for Thanksgiving, and here comes a big traffic jam, and we're like, oh no, is this going to be an hour, 15 minutes, 2 hours? You know, and it's like, I'm just like, okay, Father, I need lots more patience. So that's not me in the slide there. Just so you know, I'm not blowing my top, you know, but anyway. But that's a good time to learn patience, you know, when you're in a situation like that. Moreover, we can even dispense with fruitless comments like, why is it happening to me? Ever hear that? You can hear that from kids. They say that, why is this happening to me? Oh, boy. Well, we realize that such complaining, in fact, is counterproductive, doesn't help, since it can cause us and others unnecessary mental and emotional suffering, like our parents, for those who are young, you know. We don't want our parents to be suffering, right? Not at all. So, by choosing to be cheerful, positive, and optimistic, we can live by this famous statement. This is from Alcoholics Anonymous, but it applies to all of us. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. A little wisdom in that statement, isn't it? So just as Jesus Christ overcame the world through the profound relationship that he had with the Father, by his unconquerable power, we can do the same thing. Let's now explore another biblical illustration as to why we can have tremendous confidence and courage in any troublesome situation and still remain cheerful. Not that we're happy about it, but we're still be okay. You're positive, upbeat, confident, because your confidence is not in yourself, but in what God can do for you. The example involves Hezekiah, an extremely faithful and righteous king of ancient Judah. Again, a story many of us have heard before, but again, let's go through this. Describing righteous Hezekiah, we read in 2 Kings 18, verse 5, he trusted in the Lord God of Israel, so that after him was none like him among all the kings of Judah. This is a top guy. Nor any who were before him. For he held fast to the Lord. He did not depart from following him, but kept his commandments, which the Lord had commanded Moses. What a guy. Let's see how Hezekiah acted in the face of an enormous danger to his country. This involved the cruel and powerful Assyrian king Sennacherib, who threatened to invade Jerusalem and kill and capture all of its citizens. The first thing Hezekiah did is described in 2 Chronicles 32, verse 2. So he knew this threat was coming. He's a wise man also. When Hezekiah saw that Sennacherib had come and that his purpose was to make war against Jerusalem, he consulted with his leaders and commanders to stop the water from the springs which were outside the city, and they helped him. He was wise enough to stop the water going out to these troops and outside because they needed water, and he wanted to stop that from happening. Afterwards, Hezekiah gathered all the leaders again and the people of Jerusalem together, the people and the leaders. And he said to them in verse 7, look at this. These troops are on the outside, all around the city, ready to attack. And what does he tell the citizens of Jerusalem? Be strong and courageous. Do not be afraid nor dismayed before the king of Assyria, nor before all the multitude that is with him. Look at this now. For there are more with us than with him. Sound a little familiar? Elisha's words, right? And then he goes on and says, with him, this army outside, is a flesh, an arm of flesh. But with us is the Lord our God to help us and to fight our battles. And the people were strengthened by the words of Hezekiah, king of Judah. At that time, Sennacherib sent his field commander to chasten the people of Jerusalem outside the city walls and even arrogantly affront God. That's a no-no. God did not like that. I'm speaking on Sennacherib's behalf, who had conquered many other nations. This man shouted, remember, this is his representative, the king's representative. He said, who is there among all the gods of those nations that they had conquered that my fathers utterly destroyed that could deliver his people from my hand? That your God should be able to deliver you from my hand. Field commander then haughtily stated this, now therefore do not let Hezekiah deceive you or persuade you like this, and do not believe him. For no god of any nation or kingdom was able to deliver his people from my hand or the king hand of my fathers. How much less will your God deliver you from my hand? So, you know, you can see the people. Well, again, imagine that picture. You've got Jerusalem surrounded by thousands and thousands of troops with all kinds of weapons and everything. And this guy is, don't believe your king. You know, you can't listen to him because we're going to come and take you down. We're going to kill you. We're going to capture you. Let's go on to 2 Kings 19 to read the rest of the story. 2 Kings 19, verse 20. Then Isaiah said to the son of Amoz, send to Hezekiah, saying this. So you prophet Isaiah telling Amoz to go to Hezekiah and say this. Thus says the Lord God of Israel, because you have prayed to me against Sennacherib, king of Assyria, I have heard. Verse 32, therefore, thus says the Lord concerning the king of Assyria, he shall not come into this city, nor shoot an arrow there, nor come before it with a shield, nor build a siege mound against it. By the way that he came, by the same he shall return, and he shall not come into this city, says the Lord. Pretty powerful answer from our God to the king, who is loyal to him, really loyal. Goes on, verse 34, for I will defend this city to save it for my own sake and my servant David's sake. Of course, David was a former king who is a man after God's own heart. Verse 35, and it came to pass on that certain night, let's look at this now, that the angel of the Lord went out and killed in the camp of the Assyrians 185,000. And when the people arose early in the morning, there were the corpses, all dead. So here we saw Isaiah had placed his complete confidence in God to protect and guide him and his people, a righteous king. He put his trust in God, and God responded. God acted swiftly and decisively. This is just another biblical illustration as to why we can be of good cheer and eliminate fear and anxiety in the face of any opposition or trouble. Those are really great biblical examples, and we can look to those because the same God is on his throne right now as was back in those days. He loves us just as much as he did Hezekiah and the people at that time. So we can be totally confident and courageous in both big and small situations. Luke 1 verse 37 says, and I love this passage and I'm sure you do too, "For with God nothing will be impossible." So we looking at a situation where there's no, you can't see any hope in it. To God, it's not a problem at all. He will do it, but he wants to know where our heart is. If we are building that most holy faith that we should be building in our lives, he wants to know. I remember Mr. Armstrong used to say years ago, I remember various things he said, but he said, God will not allow anyone in his kingdom he cannot rule. Or who's going to be halfway in and out. He wants to know where our heart is. Are we with him all the way, like Hezekiah was with him at this point? Let's briefly now examine a few other passages that reveal how we can count on God all the time for his mighty help. He told the people in ancient Israel that he would always be with them if they would obey his commandments and keep the covenant that he had made with them. Of course, they didn't do that. But if they had, they would have been so blessed. Deuteronomy 4, verse 31 says, "For the Lord your God is a merciful God. He will not forsake you, nor destroy you, nor forget the covenant of your fathers, which he swore to them." But see, they wouldn't obey him. But that assurance is there for us today. So we can be of good cheer. Why? Because we know firmly that God is our shield. Deuteronomy 31 verse 8 says, "And the Lord, he is the one who goes before you. He will be with you. He will not leave you nor forsake you. Do not fear nor be dismayed." How many times have we read that even today? Don't be fearful. You don't need to be. Don't be dismayed. Leave it in God's hands. He's there for you. He can answer a two-second prayer. As the Israelites prepared to enter the promised land, this is going back in history a little bit, Joshua told them to be positive, be resilient, be fearless. Joshua 1 verse 9, he says, Have I not commanded you? Be strong and have good courage. Do not be afraid nor dismayed, for the Lord your God is with you wherever you go. Also, King David knew that fearing his enemies was completely unnecessary, since he could rely on God's overwhelming spiritual power to protect him. Psalm 27 verse 1, David writes this, "The Lord is my light and my salvation. Whom shall I fear? The Lord is the strength of my life. Of whom shall I be afraid?" Can we say that? This should be true for us today. Psalm 37 verse 7 says, "Rest in the Lord and wait patiently for him." Again, there's that word patient, long-suffering. Sometimes these things last for years. And God is trying to see it, check us out. He wants to know what we're going to do. Do not fret because of him who prospers in his way, because of the man who brings wicked schemes to pass. Just because some guy's doing something bad doesn't mean we will do the same. Got to stay away from that. How can we be anything but optimistic and of good cheer when we read the following famous and inspiring passage from the Apostle Paul? He said this in Romans 8:28, very familiar to us. And we know that all things work together for good to those who love God, to those who are called according to his purpose. And how do you love God? You obey his commandments. We obey his commandments. We do what he asks us to do. So we're called to do that. Paul also said this in Romans 8:31. Very encouraging words here. He said, "What then shall we say to these things? If God is for us, who can be against us?" Sort of like what David said, right? Now, those are magnificent passages which can lead us to an important question. Just how much does God love us? I mentioned that, but he loves us so much. How much is he concerned about us and our needs? Jesus personally said that the Father knows every hair on our heads. But Mr. Jim Call, he's a little short of those today. But we'll let it go. I did see a little in the back of his head, if you noticed. I'm slowly losing mine, so. But anyway, Matthew 10, verse 29 to 31 says, "Are not two sparrows sold for a copper coin, and that not one of them falls to the ground apart from your Father's will? But the very hairs on your head are all numbered." Imagine that. Boy. That's how much he loves. He knows us. He knows every hair on our head. He knows the functioning of our body and everything that we do. Therefore, it says here, do not fear. You are of more value than many sparrows. How much more valuable? Innumerable times higher than any sparrows. So what a fantastic promise that we have from the most powerful being in the entire universe. There is therefore no reason to be negative or downcast or hopeless, even when we encounter these long-term trials and problems. But again, you know, you got your hand out, and in a month from now, you might forget some of this. So go back and look at that handout and look at some of those scriptures, because I know how easily I forget. So we need to be reminded. That's why we come to church each Sabbath, and we go to the holy days. Everything's sort of, God helps us to remind. He needs to help us to understand and be reminded of these things, all these things. So we don't have to be hopeless. You know, during Christ's early ministry, he expressed this exact point to various individuals. Even as these people dealt with very difficult troubles, he encouraged them to be cheerful and confident and courageous. For example, to this helpless, paralytic man lying on the pallet bed that was brought to Jesus, he saw his faith and he said to the man, "Son, be of good cheer. Your sins are forgiven you." In other words, look way down the road. How great to have that happen, that Christ would be willing to do that for this man. To the frightened apostles battling the turbulent sea, we read in Matthew 14, verse 27, that immediately Jesus spoke to them saying, "Be of good cheer. It is I. Do not be afraid." To the woman who had a flow of blood for 12 years and touched his garment, he said, "Be of good cheer, daughter. Your faith has made you well. Look at what God is interested in, the heart. That's what he wants to know. Where are we coming from? So in various ways today, God will comfort us in our trials and troubles so we can be of good cheer and we can spread that same joy and confidence to others. 2 Corinthians 1, verse 3 to 4 says, "Blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, the Father of mercies and God of all comfort, who comforts us in all our tribulation." Why? "That we may be able to comfort those who are in any trouble." See, he'll comfort us, but he wants us to help others as well. He gives us that help so we can spread that to other people and tell them what God did for us. We can do that with the comfort with which we ourselves are comforted by God. So when we face difficulties, we need to realize that we are not alone. It's easy to think that. God's great love, his immense power is available to us. We just have to ask. We have to obey. With his aid, we can handle every problem, every challenge that we confront. Ephesians 1, verse 19, Paul writes this, "And what is the exceeding greatness of his power towards us who believe, according to the working of his mighty power?" That's the God that we love and obey. So, also, what did Paul tell us about worrying and fretting and anxiety? Philippians 4, verse 6, "Be anxious for nothing, but in everything," this is the answer to what to do, "but in everything by prayer and supplication with thanksgiving, let your request be known to God, and the peace of God, which surpasses all understanding, will guard your hearts and minds through Jesus Christ," Christ Jesus. Paul also wrote in 2 Timothy 1, verse 7, "For God has not given us a spirit of fear, but of power and of love and a sound mind." So that's another thing we should be praying about, wisdom to make good decisions. But to just have that relationship with God is so critically important, that we have that connection with him. Think how close David was, and Hezekiah, and Elisha, and these others. They were, you know, he was with God, boing, boing, boing. "You show God, show my servant, you know, what he needs to know, and deal with these people." That's the closeness that we should have with our God. And it says here, you know, God's going to fight our battles. And it tells us here if in Exodus 14:14, "The Lord will fight for you." Oh, he's on your side. What better ally would you want than your Father in heaven? "And you shall hold your peace." In other words, don't worry. I got it covered. He's going to help you through it in some way. He's going to find you. You're going to find yourself on the other side of this problem. And he's going to not put you into anything that's too hard for you to handle. That's how merciful he is as well. So it's through in Philippians 4, verse 13 says, "I can do all things," Paul writes, "through Christ who strengthens me." And we can say the same thing. With that being said, the bottom line in everything we've covered today is, in fact, that we don't have to fear anything. Nothing. General Eisenhower finally, you know, he issued that command to his officers and staff during the Battle of the Bulge, that only cheerful faces will be at this conference table. How did they respond? How did the generals and the staff respond? He wrote in his autobiography, Eisenhower did, he said, quote, "The situation was carefully reviewed and was gratifying to find that every man present, whether a commander or staff officer, was cool and confident. I did not hear any remark that indicated hysteria or excessive fear. So, you know, you and I can have that cool and confident approach spiritually. Considering the overwhelming scriptural evidence we've read today, it's clear that worry and fear and dismay can be totally excluded from our lives. Not that it's going to happen overnight. These things, it takes time. It takes time to learn these things. But those negative attitudes can be substituted with God-given optimism and faith and courage. Indeed, through his great power and continual aid, this is how you can be of good cheer.